It's the What's Your Sign edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, a rant about the new Fair Elections Act and a back-to-basic look at astrology. Let's begin episode 242.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. It is me, Don, your political scientist and skeptical philosopher. There is a coup occurring, and it's not one of those third world banana republics, but right here in Canada. It's been slow but steady, and recently has been moving with more and more speed. There was the elimination of the mandatory long-form census. It may seem like a minor thing, but we no longer have a reliable way to understand or measure our nation. There's the muzzling of our scientists, the loyalty oath for civil servants, and there's a time bomb set last year where Revenue Canada was given a special allocation of $8 million funding to investigate environmental, quote, extremist organizations. I say extremist because that is how the Harper government is now addressing any group that opposes its policies, especially with regards to resource extraction plans. They're investigating the David Suzuki Foundation because they may be laundering money for terrorists. Seriously? The latest and perhaps most dangerous move is the overhaul of our democracy that conservatives are laughingly called the Fair Elections Act. This act has so many issues, it's hard to know where to begin. Let's start with its conception. Who was in on creating the act? You would think extensive consultations would have been made with the important stakeholders, perhaps coast-to-coast public forums, a call from submissions from institutions, at least collaboration with Election Canada. But no, it appears that the creation of this bill was done in isolation. The minister did tout, with misplaced pride, I believe, that last year he took a whole hour out of his schedule to talk to Canada's current Chief Electoral Officer, Mark Mayard, and said that Mayard could drop by any time if he had some ideas. That's it. Not even the previous elections officer has been consulted on this. It has been standard procedure, too, when a bill that, you know, affects a Crown corporation or similar government agency, to give a draft copy of that bill to the head of that institution for review and comment. As Mayard has stated in the past, his department was actively engaged in the creation of electoral legislation. But that's not what happened this time. It also appears that a Crown Commission set up to look at electoral reform wasn't even consulted. In fact, there's little evidence that the Harper government truly consulted, anyone but their own party hacks. This may explain why the Fair Election Act looks more like the Shredding of Elections Act or Protecting Conservatives from Democracy Act. Like so many bills the Harper government have shoved down the throats of Canadians, this bill is no minor tweak, not addressing a single issue. This is a broad-based reworking of Elections Canada. It changes many things over various areas, from reporting election results, voter ID, robocalls, campaign financing, how to deal with election fraud, and much, much more. In the past, you would say that there is something in this for everyone to hate, and the bill would be doomed. But the genius of Harper is he has reversed this trend. It seems that if there's at least one thing in there that someone thinks is worthy of voting for, they'll vote for the whole thing. We're nuts, people. Maybe saying genius is giving him too much credit. When you have a majority in Parliament and a submissive Conservative Party, well, he could have introduced a bill banning hockey and probably got it passed into law. Let's take a moment and look at the official line as to what issues the bill is supposed to address. And I shall quote liberally, forgive the pun, from the government's own press release. So what's in the bill? Well, there is a removal of a ban on reporting election results before polls close. This was already struck down by the Supreme Court and was practically unenforceable anyway, thanks to the internet. So when the polls close in Ontario, we here in BC will know either who won, or if it's too close to call, we can rush out at the last minute and vote. In a cosmetic nod to their past wrongdoings, there will be now a registry for robocall centers. So if Pierre Poutine orders more misleading calls, we will know for sure who did the actual calling, if not who actually ordered the crime, calls. Although they will only be required to keep the records for 1 year, which means the 2011 robocall scandal, currently under investigation, would have had their records destroyed years ago. Well, we can always call CSEC or NSA to get those records back, I guess. It would be illegal to impersonate an election officer for the purpose of preventing people from voting, which sounds good until you realize it's only really window dressing. It already is a crime to prevent people from voting, irrespective of the method. You must wonder why they didn't make it a crime just to impersonate an elections officer, full stop. It also prevents Election Canada from revealing they are investigating an event. Consider how important getting public input was with regards to the robocall scandal. They would not muzzle the investigator that was unless, oh yes, it was a Conservative Link scandal, wasn't it? Okay, now I see. It would also compel Elections Canada to inform the candidate in question that there is an investigation going on, just in case they had not yet shredded any of that incriminating evidence. This is, from what I have researched, virtually unique in the world. Another, well, gray area, if an MP is accused of electoral wrongdoing, currently while being investigated, that member cannot sit or vote in the House. This bill will allow them to act as an MP while their legitimacy is being investigated. This one is gray because often the investigations relate really to just sloppy paperwork and not actual wrongdoing. No one would want a general fraudster to vote on any bill. The potential impact is far too great to tolerate. But sloppy lapses, well, that makes the provision seem a little heavy-handed. Unless you were a law and order government who believed in mandatory sentences, strict adherence to the law, they would say that laxity only encourages criminality. So you think the Conservatives, who would put your arse in jail over a joint, would be litigious over electoral wrongdoing. But not so much when they're involved. They become the, relax, man, people are people and shit happens, let it go. So they will let a potential criminal vote on laws of the land, but use every effort to close down the InSite safe injection site because that's morally wrong. Oh yes, and they will allow an extra day for voting, which is good. But most experts agree that what should be done is to make Election Day a national holiday. And many people believe it's best to actually make voting mandatory. So no real commitment to real reform then. One of the things that is missing from this bill is the one power that the elections officer stated as necessary to enforce Canadians' election laws, and that is the power to compel testimony. That is, if Elections Canada launches an investigation in something like, oh, I don't know how someone may have access to a voter database used to fraudulently call voters, there, the investigator must ask for cooperation of the potential criminals. There is no way to compel them to testify or even turn over pertinent documents or evidence. Note, this is not a dictatorial power. Just like the RCMP, the commissioner would still have to obtain a sort of court order. This is why you hear that Election Canada often involves the RCMP, because the RCMP does have the power to subpoena. But of course, before they can call in the RCMP, they must already have a strong case of wrongdoing, which of course they can't show because they can't subpoena documents. It's a catch-22. If the Harper government truly wished to, were really serious about fighting fraud, to use their own quote, give the office sharp teeth, this would seem a no-brainer. So on the one hand, the Conservatives have defined a whole new set of offenses. Good on them for that. And yet they have not provided even the most basic tool for the commissioner to actually pursue potential offenders. That's what we used to call a paper tiger, fierce on paper, but having no real enforceability. For example, in the robocall scandal, the lead investigator stated that their ability to make progress was severely restricted because people were not willing to cooperate or talk to them. Lack of any ability to compel compliance, the investigation lingers on years later with only one possible conviction. It's important to note that Harper claims his party was cooperating with investigators, but this simple complaint shows the bald-faced lie such a comment is. No wonder what would actually be a useful reform is absent in the Harperization of Elections Canada. Another glaring oversight was the information political entities have to provide to Elections Canada. one of the biggest gray areas of politics is campaign spending. As it currently is, a candidate and party entities only have to provide a summary report of their expenses. What would have been progressive and a real step forward to help ensure transparency and a truly fair democracy, a change in the law the chief elections officer has asked for, it would have had candidates and party offices provide Election Canada financial documents to support the returns. Wait a minute! What was that? Currently, candidates and party offices provide overall reports of expenses. So $300 for advertising, $200 for coffee, no specifics. A truly effective audit would require receipts. You say you spent $200 on coffee? Could you please supply the Tim Hortons receipts? This is something fundamental to any form of fiscal accountability, which of course is why the Conservatives overlooked it. How can any oversight be conducted if we must rely on the honor system? Harper is quick to remove the vote voucher system because of potential abuse, but feck you if you want that to know what he spent his campaign money or what money he had to spend. It is amazing, if you think about it, that any fiscal wrongdoing could be detected at all. It must be of such major magnitudes, of such contempt for the system, that any election fraud can be uncovered in the first place under the existing rules. Wrongdoing, though, the Conservatives, in their arrogance, have reportedly perpetrated many times. If Harper really cared about Canadian democracy, this is one thing that would have made a significant difference. But Harper seems to not give a shite about Canada, and this is but one example of his contempt for this nation. They mask one improvement around campaign fundraising by saying that it, quote, keeps big money out. And how are they keeping big money out? By increasing the maximum donation from $1,200 to $1,500. Okay, beyond the irony, a $300 increase may not seem that big. It's only 5%. But when you dig deeper, you find that the number of donors who give more than $200 favors one party over another. Guess which one? The NDP has about 3,500 donors above the $200 mark. The Liberals, a little over 7,000. Oh, but look, the Conservatives have well over 10,000 big donors. To be extreme, if we assume, and yes, it's not really a reasonable assumption, but it is exemplative, every 200-plus donor gave the maximum donation. The Conservatives would get more than $1 million than the Liberals would, and $2.25 million more than the donations the NDP would receive. Sounds like big money to me. The NDP, a fellow mouse, have pointed out that one exemption from campaign spending limits will be money spent on people who previously donated to the party to give more money. That is, campaign spending for fundraising will not be considered campaign expenses. Because they, just because? This loophole is estimated to be about one-fifth of campaign spending, i.e. about one-fifth of the amount of money spent on campaigns is spent on the base to get more money. Establishment parties will be the only ones who can benefit from this loophole. This would impede the ability of new parties to arise. Ironically, considering the current Conservative Party / Reform Party roots, a loophole that would have prevented Harper from rising to power. That 20% bonus would not be available to new parties, thus giving a systemic institutional advantage to established parties, like the Conservative Party now. Funny, they were not mentioning such policies in 2003, but it's standard operating procedure for Harper to oppose things when they hurt his rise to power and support them when it can secure his power. So, in the spirit of, what was that line again? Keeping big money out, this part, coupled with the increased donation limits, would amount to an increase of 25% more money in campaigns. Seems like another Harperism. Keeping money out means bringing more in. I am curious, a logical extension of this idea, if I spend $1 million on ads and my party won 30% of the vote, does this mean that I can say that $300,000 of that ad does not actually count as political advertising because it was seen by previous supporters? We can see in the US the destructive power of money in democracy. Harper has seen how it has allowed the Republicans to thwart the will of the people. First, it's one person, one vote. Then $1, one vote. Then it's only the votes of corporations that count. One of the things that are to be removed from our elections is the process of vouching. This is where a confirmed elector vouches for another non-confirmed elector. and they are making them eligible to vote. I personally have been an election officer in both provincial and federal elections, and I can tell you this is not a common practice, and one not taken lightly. This event occurs mostly when you have an elderly member of the family lacking proper ID, but has a spouse or child that vouches they are who they are and live where they say. To prevent fraud, names are recorded, oaths are taken, a paper trail is created so that if later on deceit is suspected, crimes can be convicted. It's also used sometimes when a couple comes in and one has left their wallet slash purse at home. The one spouse vouches for the other. In both cases, the election officer assesses that the people's claims are valid and plausible. That said, in my experience, if you had 3 out of 100 people use this option, that would be a lot. According to the chief elections officer, he starts off stating that every Canadian has the right to vote, that the franchise is the most fundamental right in a democracy. To deny that right is untenable to democracy. A number of people who vouch is about 100,000. That works out to roughly 325 votes per district. From my research, only 7 seats in the last election could possibly have been corrupted by voter vouching. So this really seems like a non-issue that only has the intent of suppressing voter turnout. Now, you could push back and say, hey, Don, you just said that vouching doesn't really change election results. So who cares if they don't vote? I mean, beyond the whole it's your right to vote thing. Well, there is the what I'm going to call the resistance effect. The more people think that it's difficult to vote, the less likely they are to turn out and vote. This becomes amplified for people who are voting that are already under certain degrees of hardships. The polls are open 12 hours, let's say 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. You get up at 7, you get the kids to school by 8, you got to get to work. You get off at 5, maybe 6, you have to work a little late. Then you need to remember, oh, it's election day. I mean, work can be exhausting and things like that will slip your mind. Then you need to remember where you're supposed to vote. You only had an hour for lunch. Do you eat or vote? Most people would eat. Then you have a couple hours after work. This is where the resistance effects takes hold. You think, do I have the right ID? I remember them mentioning something in the news that's really important now. What is valid ID? Ah, crap, screw it. They're probably not going to let me vote anyway. And I'm tired and I'm hungry. In fact, let's just go to McDonald's. Go to bed, get up, go to work, and have at her again. Life happens. Voter suppression from 100,000 people could be maybe 10 times as much. That can really swing an election. One of the, quote, innovations of the bill is to make the Commissioner of Elections Canada, the person responsible for investigating electoral wrongdoing, independent of the chief elections officer. In that simple statement, there's an implication that the current elections officer is somehow biased, a theme throughout the bill, and that placing them under ministerial control vis-a-vis the Attorney General will make them less partisan. Not that anyone has complained about the independence of the Elections Commissioner. That said, the Conservative government has a history of casting anyone who does not toe the Harper line as suspect. Harper's government views any nonpartisan independent agency as an opponent, even Elections Canada. To the Conservative mindset, the fact that they have investigated for wrongdoing can only mean Elections Canada is anti-Harper. Perhaps in the same way the mob thinks that the RCMP are anti-mob. It's not the people, but their questionable activities that makes them targets. If Harper truly wanted Elections Canada to treat his party like the rest, he should tell his party to stop breaking the law. The Minister of Democratic Reform, a Norwellian term if I've ever heard one, stated that, and I quote, "The problem at the moment is that there is no check on the authority of the chief electoral officer. He's responsible to Parliament, but in reality, he does not answer to anyone." So it seems that the Harper government sees Parliament as nobody. But there is a method to this seemingly minor provision. Currently, Elections Canada, and more to the point, the chief electoral officer, is not responsible to the government. A minister, the PMO, i.e. he's not responsible to Harper, but to the Parliament of Canada. By moving the investigative branch, the commissioner, out of Elections Canada's office and under the Attorney General, the commissioner is now no longer accountable to Parliament, not to the people of Canada, but to the Harper government. All must swear allegiance to the PMO. Now, one could say that these are not ideological in nature, that there's no hidden agenda, But one thing the minister said was very telling. He said that he did not want the referee wearing a team jersey, making a hockey reference every Canadian can understand. Why would he say that? No one has ever, to the best of my knowledge, claimed Election Canada was partisan. The Conservatives may be upset with the transgressions they've been accused and sometimes charged with. Think In-N-Out scandal, robocalls, breaking campaign spending rules, and more. But the Liberals and the NDP have faced similar issues, if not to the same extent or perniciousness. I should remind people that in the budget, Harper cut funding to Elections Canada by almost $8 million. Hey, I think I found where the money that was used to attack the environmental groups came from. If the intent was to punish Elections Canada for daring to make the Conservative Party follow the law, well, I think funding cuts would be the weapon of choice. It hampers their ability to safeguard a democracy. Less money means less ability to investigate shenanigans or criminal activities, depending on whether you're a conservative or not, I guess. Harper has a history of punishing independent bodies that challenge the Conservative government. Think Kevin Page of the Parliamentary Budget Office, who dared to ask for the real numbers behind things like the F-35 fighter jet. Maneer Sikh, head of Stats Canada, who challenged Harper over the census and how much damage eliminating the long form would be to Canada's ability to understand itself. Think Linda Keane of the Nuclear Safety Commission, who closed down an unsafe nuclear power plant and was fired for her efforts. Think Richard Colvin, a civil servant whistleblower into torture in Afghanistan. A pattern can be seen. But no, the Fair Election Act is far more malicious, far more reaching than just institution bashing. There is a deep sense of contempt. It ties in with the silencing of the chief electoral officer, who may now only, and let me repeat, only talk about when to vote and where to vote and nothing else. Heil Harper. I have mentioned on the show before the things that happened in the U.S., electoral corruption, for lack of a less offensive, if also less accurate word, happens here about a decade or so later. So a really big thing in the U.S., it really kind of got started in 2002 when Bush signed the Help Americans Vote Act, which required ID to register or vote. This started the current wave of requiring voter ID. Why? Well, the Democratic base are composed largely of the poor, the young, immigrants, people who either have trouble getting official ID or who are just too busy to get it. These people are statistically and dramatically unable to get government ID, can't afford it, don't need it, can't get it. Yet they still have the right to vote. Coincidentally, these people also tend to vote Democratic by a large margin. The results of these laws is to reduce the turnout of Democratic voters. Republican voters tend to be more affluent and have more free time and lack institutional barriers. In a now infamous, if refreshingly honest, comment by the Republican governor of Pennsylvania, who said that Pennsylvania's recent voter ID law would allow the Republican presidential candidate to win the state of Pennsylvania. Most of us, we're not really poor, and we forget how hard it can be to do something as simple as just pay rent. If you get a BC ID or a driver's license for a particular address, but you end up moving three times a year or even once a year because you can't afford rent for a month or two and you had to move in with your sister, well, that license is worthless to you as ID because you no longer live at that address. And then they charge you to change the address. And this is someone who can barely afford rent, let alone food and whatnot. Changing your address on your government issue ID is not a priority. So Republicans have learned that to actively make it harder to vote, they increase the chances that they will win elections. This fact has not gone unnoticed by Harper, it seems. So when this law muzzles Elections Canada, when you think about what kind of speech Harper is stopping by this law, it's the bring out the vote speech. It's the right to vote speech, the need to vote speech, the obligation to vote speech. It's the outreach to high school kids to get them out to vote. It's the outreach to the homeless to get them registered to vote. It's the outreach to minority communities to remind them that they can vote. To Harper and his conservatives, this is dangerous to their electoral success. And we have another answer to the question. Why does the minister think the referee is wearing a team jersey? Because if he, the elections officer, who, by the way, says, quote, "The only jersey I think I'm wearing, if you have to carry that analogy, I believe is the one with the stripes, black and white, promotes voters to vote. If he encourages everyone who is eligible to cast a ballot to do so, if people start to think that their voice counts, that goes against the Harper strategy." He also said that this law would, quote, "take the referee off the ice." Think about it. Which is easier? Have the Conservative Party change its policies to attract a greater diversity of voters, or simply create barriers for that diversity from voting and focus only on the corporatist agenda that's got them elected so far? And on the issue of bring out the vote, the minister said political candidates who are aspiring for office are far better at inspiring voters to get out and cast their ballots than a government bureaucracy. Which, even if we assumed were true, and it's not, if we were, then why has there been a decline in voter turnout? But again, even if true, he is implying that campaigns by Election Canada are suppressing votes. Even if they do nothing, they do no harm. Why muzzle them unless you have an ulterior motive, such as, just for example, voter suppression? It is also telling that, as per standard procedure now, a bill that has no consultation is being pushed through Parliament. The Conservatives has limited debate on the bill that will gut our electoral system. Maybe it's coincidence, maybe it's habit, or maybe it's a coup. How big is this? Why do I call it a coup? Listen to what the Chief Electoral Officer has to say about it. Now first, I should put this into some context. Mark Marand doesn't often speak to the public outside of his role of promoting democracy. He's described as reserved and understated. And yet when the CBC described him, well, just listen and get an idea of how unusual and radical this law is, how much it has shaken Maillard. How the interviewer, Evan Solomons, describes Mr. Maillard.
Pierre Poilievre, I spoke with the Chief Electoral Officer, Marc Mahon, earlier on this program. He was very clearly very upset. I would say a quiet fury when he was discussing some of the changes. Here's one example.
Basically, my reading of the Act is that I can no longer speak about democracy in this country except 2 points, where and when to vote.
Sir, do you feel muzzled?
I would say that I'm not aware of any electoral bodies around the world who cannot talk about democracy.
How does that make you feel?
Well, I think it's something that should be worrisome for... I don't think it reflects a model democracy that Canadians aspire to.
Worrisome. He was choking back words there. It was an emotional response, Chris.
One of the things that came out of the interview with Canada's Chief Electoral Officer, Mark Maillard, about the bill was the almost desperate pleading he had for the people of Canada to speak up, for members of Parliament to take on the Harper government and stop the destruction of yet another Canadian institution, for the destruction of democracy in Canada. I think, in the interview I heard on the publicly owned CBC, another institution we must defend, on it, well, listen, tell me if it does not send a chill up your spine.
Well, I think there's a very broad clause in the Act that's basically saying from now on, when this comes into force, Elections Canada cannot communicate with the public here or around the world about anything other than how and when to vote or where and when to vote.
In other words, this interview, if this bill passes, you couldn't do this interview with me.
Your range of questions would have to be quite restricted, as long as you ask me question about where and when to vote.
Your opinion on a piece of legislation you wouldn't be allowed to talk about.
That's interesting, because when I'll be called in Parliament, that will raise an interesting issue at that point. Most of the reports that we publish will no longer be published.
Most of the reports will no longer be published?
No, most of the research will not no longer be published, because these are communication to the public and they don't necessarily always deal. The commissioner issued a report regarding his activities.
Right.
That has nothing to do with how and when to vote, so these reports would no longer be available.
And
in fact, not only available, I don't think they would be done at all.
So, and give me an example of what that will mean. I mean, for someone listening who might not be familiar with some of your reports, what's a report that you believe is important now that you won't be able to do if this passes?
Well, all the reports we've done and the research and the report we've done on electors' behavior, why they vote, what is the issue with young voter, for example, who are facing challenges over the years. Elections Canada has published numerous studies on Aboriginals, on new citizens, on young people. More and more we're looking, because that's going to be an issue in the next few years about seniors voting and the challenges they're facing.
Sir, do you feel muzzled?
I would say that I'm not aware of any electoral bodies around the world who cannot talk about democracy.
You are not aware of any other electoral body around the world that would be incapable of speaking about democracy. You're saying this would be the most restrictive rules around any electoral officer in a democracy?
That I'm aware of, yes.
How does that make you feel?
Well, I think it's something that should be worrisome for... I don't think it reflects a model democracy that Canadians aspire to.
Allow me to repeat. My reading of the Act is that I can no longer speak about democracy in this country. I am not aware of any electoral body around the world who cannot talk about democracy. Let's hear that again.
Sir, do you feel muzzled?
I would say that I'm not aware of any electoral bodies around the world who cannot talk about democracy.
You are not aware of any other electoral body around the world that would be incapable of speaking about democracy. You're saying this would be the most restrictive rules around any electoral officer in a democracy?
That I'm aware of, yes.
How does that make you feel?
Well, I think it's something that should be worrisome for... I don't think it reflects a model democracy that Canadians aspire to.
On that note, I must remind listeners, never forget 2015. There will be a reckoning. We'll return after this break with a look at how astronomy can help your love life at Valentine's. Okay, not really, but a look into astrology.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
Hello, and we're back. So there's been a bit of a controversy lately over the decision of the McMillan Space Center to allow a Valentine's show entitled Cosmological Love Connection to use their facilities. The blurb from the show goes like this. Hey babe, what's your sign? Join us in the Planetarium Star Theater and celebrate Valentine's Day with a fun, lighthearted, and romantic look at the night sky from both the perspective of an astrologer and an astronomical point of view. Now, on first glance, it could be someone using astrology, something we know in our culture, as a way of informing people about astronomy. Maybe something about how real science allows us to understand where astrology goes wrong. So I thought I would do a little investigation into the presenters of the show. A Rose Marcus of Astrolink, a site that promotes evolutionary astrology, she offers charts reading, she also has tarot cards and clairvoyance, she promotes webinars on these topics on our website. So of course, what is evolutionary astrology, you might ask? She states it as, and I quote, "Evolutionary astrology studies the past life dynamics that have brought an individual to present circumstances and level of personal development. But understanding the past and how far one has come, one can learn how best to facilitate the soul's intended growth for the current life." Now, before I discuss the other co-presenters, some have claimed that a public educational institution should not be allowed to promote such crap as astrology. I will explain later why it's crap, but for the moment, let's assume. The center rents out its facilities. The Star Theater seats about 230 people. It costs $200 an hour to rent. Tickets about $13. So about 20 or so people show up, and the rest is profit. I mentioned profit because this is a bit of a commercial exchange. If the center had banned this event, it's likely that it would have been sued. What is more curious is the listed co-host, Dr. Jeremy Matthews. He qualifies as a real astronomer and excellent at presenting science to the public. He's even presented at Skeptic Camp on who needs the paranormal. So I'm wondering how this show will ultimately work out. With him on the show, I do have some minor hope it will be actually an educational event after all. So I asked your indulgence on calling astrology crap. Let me now explain. So to start, what is astrology? The simple explanation is our lives, our fates, are written in the stars. From the moment of our birth to our deaths, understanding where our star sign is can provide guidance as to how to live our lives and what events will lie in our future. Well, not really, but I shall pretend it's true. The likely origin of astrology lays in our first species understanding that patterns in the night sky repeat. In a very simplistic way, we could, quote, predict when the weather would turn cold by the position of the stars. It's likely things that migration patterns of animals or fruiting times of plants were correlated with star movements. It was only a matter of time that people began to think that the secret knowledge of the sky could tell us something about our own personal lives. Voila, a charlatan is born. The first people to organize the sky into the zodiac, as we know them, were the second millennium Babylonians, although there is some speculation that the Sumerians were casting horoscopes 1,000 years earlier. Regardless, the Babylonians definitely were using the stars for divination. The hope was, in a world that mortals had little control over, the stars would help them predict disasters or the right time to attack the neighboring kingdom. When was the best time to have a child to ensure it would be a strong king? It's important to note, this is also a time when, quote, seers used the entails of animals to predict the same kind of future. It was not until the Persians invaded Egypt, and then Alexander the Great invaded, and finally the Ptolemaic dynasty, that the horoscope astrology, as we know it, was born. And that was in about the 2nd-ish century BCE. By the Middle Ages, astrology was not only used to predict the rise and fall of empires, or whether the king should marry that princess or not, but it was also an active part of diagnostic medicine. Yes, before medical treatment was performed, it was the duty of the, quote, doctor to ensure the stars were appropriately aligned to ensure maximal effect. It was during the Enlightenment that astrology metamorphed into astronomy. Some have credited the work of Johannes Kepler, who was a firm believer in astrology and yet proved the perfect spheres of astrology was wrong, and his three laws paved the way for Voyager leaving the solar system. It's one of the darkest embarrassments of modern science that the eminent father of physics, Isaac Newton, wrote far more in alchemy and astrology than on physics. Okay, maybe not as much in astrology, but definitely alchemy. But the point is, at this time, one could be forgiven for thinking astrology was a valid science. It is interesting that, thanks to the wobble of the Earth, that my actual zodiac is not my actual astrological zodiac. Or maybe put a different way, my astrological zodiac does not conform with my astrological zodiac. Astrologically, Capricorns are born between the 25th of December and the 20th of January. But the time that Capricorn rises is actually on the between the 15th of January and the 14th of February. Whew, so technically I am still a Capricorn. But you can see as time goes, the facts of astrology are contradicted by the reality of the universe. I've heard some believers state that the constellations were only placeholders. It's not the stars per se, but that portion of sky, which is constant. So it seems a failure vis-a-vis the actual. Where are the planets and the stars? Re-horoscope. But, well, can the stars have an influence on us? Let's just assume for the moment. Can the stars actually influence our lives? Well, often it is mentioned that the alignment of the stars have a gravitational effect. And I'm, of course, excluding energy field effects here. Well, okay, let's go into all that. What is an energy field? Honestly, it's nothing. It's like saying, what is a box full of stuff? What is stuff? Nothing. There's no such thing as energy. I hear gasps from the audience. Energy means nothing in and of itself. It's a placeholder, or maybe a placeholder for a measure of something else. Energy can be electricity, gravity, kinetic motion, chemicals. Energy in and of itself simply means a unit or measure that does work. It's a unit of measure. It is not a thing in itself. That is, it's a measure of something else. There is no thing called energy. But there's lots of stuff that can do work we call energy. Think sugar, think battery, think gasoline. So when an astrologer says that the planets have influence, have energies that can influence ourselves, what do they mean? Well, they could mean light from the stars. But that would mean that any child born indoors would not be affected. It could mean gravity. Jupiter is big and has lots of gravity. But the laws of physics states that although less massive, but much, much closer, your pediatrician has much more gravitational influence on you than Jupiter does. So we're left with some sort of imaginary force. And well, that's actually okay. There have been times in the history of progress where we've known that there's a force, but not actually known what that force is. In the past, magnetism. Currently, think dark matter or dark energy. These are real effects with unknown causes. We could say that the effects of astrology are real even if we have no idea about how it works. Okay. But there is a catch to that. We know that dark matter exists because it has a consistent, measurable effect on the universe. Consistent. There have been many studies to show that the effects of the mysterious dark matter, it matters. Yet every experiment into astrology has shown nothing more than random chance. This is where the astrologist must either put up or shut up. They make claims for a force, which they cannot prove actually exists, that influence the worlds in a way that they cannot actually prove is actually being influenced. So it seems to me the case is closed. Astrology is bunk. But I would like to put an epilogue onto this. I actually kind of like horoscopes in some ways. In the same way I used to use cold reading with tarot cards in high school. It was a psychological method of introspection or talk therapy. I do not think this justifies the millions of dollars that are wasted in this industry, but even the most blatant woo sometimes can have some redeeming qualities. Okay, now some of you may think, hey Don, that was a pretty quick and light treatment of astrology. And yeah, that's kind of true. So I'm going to end the show with a clip from Carl Sagan's Cosmos series, where he basically does the whole debunking of astrology and does it much better than I could have. So this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
There are two ways to view the stars, as they really are and as we might wish them to be. These are the Pleiades, a group of young stars astronomers recognize as leaving their stellar nurseries of gas and dust. And this is the Crab Nebula, a stellar graveyard where gas and dust are being dispersed back into the interstellar medium. Inside it is a dying pulsar. Both the Pleiades and the Crab Nebula are in a constellation that astrologers long ago named Taurus the Bull. They imagined it to influence our daily lives. Astronomers say that the planet Saturn is an immense globe of hydrogen and helium, encircled by a ring of snowballs 50,000 kilometers wide, and that Jupiter's great red spot is a giant storm raging for perhaps a million years. But the astrologers see the planets as affecting human character and fate. Jupiter represents a regal bearing and a gentle disposition. And Saturn, the gravedigger, fosters, they say, mistrust, suspicion, and evil. To the astronomers, Mars is a place as real as the Earth, a world awaiting exploration. But the astrologers see Mars as a warrior, the instigator of quarrels, violence, and destruction. Astronomy and astrology were not always so distinct. For most of human history, the one encompassed the other. But there came a time when astronomy escaped from the confines of astrology. The two traditions began to diverge in the life and mind of Johannes Kepler. It was he who demystified the heavens by discovering that a physical force lay behind the motions of the planets. He was the first astrophysicist and the last scientific astrologer. The intellectual foundations of astrology were swept away 300 years ago, and yet astrology is still taken seriously by a great many people. Have you ever noticed how easy it is to find a magazine on astrology? Virtually every newspaper in America has a daily column on astrology. Almost none of them have even a weekly column on astronomy. People wear astrological pendants, check their horoscopes before leaving the house. Even our language preserves an astrological consciousness. For example, take the word disaster. It comes from the Greek for bad star. The Italians once believed that disease was caused by the influence of the stars. It's the origin of our word influenza. The zodiacal signs used by astrologers even ornament this statue of Prometheus in New York City. Prometheus, who stole fire from the gods. What is all this astrology business? Fundamentally, it's the contention that which constellations the planets are in at the moment of your birth profoundly influences your future. A few thousand years ago, the idea developed that the motions of the planets determine the fates of kings, dynasties, empires. Astrologers studied the motions of the planets and asked themselves what had happened last time that, say, Venus was rising in the constellation of the goat. Maybe something similar would happen this time as well. It was a subtle and risky business. Astrologers became employed only by the state. In many countries, it became a capital offense for anyone but the official astrologer to read the portents in the skies. Why? Because a good way to overthrow a regime was to predict its downfall. Chinese court astrologers who made inaccurate predictions were executed. Others simply doctored the records so that afterwards they were in perfect conformity with events. Astrology developed into a strange discipline, a mixture of careful observations, mathematics, and record-keeping, with fuzzy thinking and pious fraud. Nevertheless, astrology survived and flourished. Why? Because it seems to lend a cosmic significance to the routine of our daily lives. It pretends to satisfy our longing to feel personally connected with the universe. Astrology suggests a dangerous fatalism. If our lives are controlled by a set of traffic signals in the sky, why try to change anything? Here, look at this. Here's two different newspapers published in the same city on the same day. Let's see what they do about astrology. Suppose you were a Libra that is born between September 23rd and October 22nd. According to the astrologer for the New York Post, compromise will help ease tension. Well, maybe. It's sort of vague. According to the New York Daily News' astrologer, demand more of yourself. Well, also vague, but also pretty different. It's interesting that these predictions are not predictions. They tell you what to do. They don't say what's going to happen. They're consciously designed to be so vague that it could apply to anybody, and they disagree with each other. Astrology can be tested by the lives of twins. There are many real cases like this. One twin is killed in childhood in, say, a riding accident or is struck by lightning, but the other lives to a prosperous old age. Suppose that happened to me. My twin and I would be born in precisely the same place and within minutes of each other. Exactly the same planets would be rising at our births. If astrology were valid, how could we have such profoundly different fates? It turns out that astrologers can't even agree among themselves what a given horoscope means. In careful tests, they're unable to predict the character and future of people they know nothing else about except the time and place of birth. Also,
How could it possibly work? How could the rising of Mars at the moment of my birth affect me, then or now? I was born in a closed room. Light from Mars couldn't get in. The only influence of Mars which could affect me was its gravity. But the gravitational influence of the obstetrician was much larger than the gravitational influence of Mars. Mars is a lot more massive, but the obstetrician was a lot closer.
The desire to be connected with the cosmos reflects a profound reality. For we are connected, not in the trivial ways that the pseudoscience of astrology promises, but in the deepest ways. Our little planet is under the influence of a star. The sun warms us. It drives the weather. It sustains all living things. 4 billion years ago, it brought forth life on Earth. But our sun is only one of a billion trillion stars within the observable universe. And those countless suns all obey natural laws, some of which are already known to us. How did we discover that there are such laws?
If we lived on a planet where nothing ever changed, there wouldn't be much to do. There'd be nothing to figure out. There'd be no impetus for science. And if we lived in an unpredictable world, where things changed in random or very complex ways, we wouldn't be able to figure things out. And again, there'd be no such thing as science. But we live in an in-between universe, where things change all right, but according to patterns, rules, or as we call them, laws of nature. If I throw a stick up in the air, it always falls down. If the sun sets in the west, it always rises again the next morning in the east. And so it's possible to figure things out. We can do science, and with it, we can improve our lives. Human beings are good at understanding the world. We always have been. We were able to hunt game or build fires only because we had figured something out. There once was a time, before television, before motion pictures, before radio, before books. The greatest part of human existence was spent in such a time. And then, over the dying embers of the campfire, on a moonless night, we watched the stars. The night sky is interesting. There are patterns there. If you look closely, you can see pictures.
One of the easiest constellations to recognize lies in the northern skies. In North America, it's called the Big Dipper. The French have a similar idea. They call it la casserole, the casserole. In medieval England, this same pattern of stars reminded people of a simple wooden plow. The ancient Chinese had a more sophisticated notion. To them, these stars carried the celestial bureaucrat on his rounds about the pole of the sky, seated on the clouds and accompanied by his eternally hopeful petitioners. The people of Northern Europe imagined yet another pattern. To them, it was Charles's wain, or wagon, a medieval cart. But other cultures saw these seven stars as part of a larger picture. It was the tail of a great bear, which the ancient Greeks and Native Americans saw instead of the handle of a dipper. But surely the most imaginative interpretation of this larger group of stars was that of the ancient Egyptians. They made out a curious procession of a bull and a reclining man, followed by a strolling hippopotamus with a crocodile on its back. What a marvelous diversity in the images various cultures saw in this particular constellation. But the same is true for all the other constellations.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite...
Where do you think you're going? Nobody's leaving. Nobody's walking out on this fun old-fashioned family Christmas. No, no! Hey!
We're kicking off our fun old-fashioned family Christmas by heading out into the country.
It's Christmas. We're all in misery.
No, no! We're all in this together. We're gonna press on. We're gonna have the happiest Christmas. Take a look around. This is a full-blown 4-alarm holiday emergency here.
It's Christmas, every Christmas, we're all in misery.
We're all in this together.
It's Christmas, every
this is a full-blown 4-alarm holiday emergency here.
It's Christmas, every Christmas, we're all in misery.
Hallelujah! Holy shit!
Drum roll, please. I hear it too.
Holiday emergency here. Blow 4-alarm holiday emergency here. Emergency here. We're gonna press on.
What's that sound?
What's all the yelling about?
Do you hear it? It's a funny sound.
Holiday emergency here. Blow 4-alarm holiday emergency here.
Simply solve the problem.
Press on, we're gonna have the happiest Christmas. Take a look around you, we're at the threshold of hell. This is a full-blown 4-alarm holiday emergency here.
It's Christmas, every Christmas, we're all in misery.
We're all in this together.
It's Christmas, every
this is a full-blown 4-alarm holiday emergency here.
It's Christmas, every
the jolliest assholes beside the nut house. My tree.
Christmas, every Christmas, we're all in misery.
We're all in this together.
It's Christmas, every
hey! Holy shit!
Today in the news.
And today in the news.
Today in the news.
Tired of the same few voices giving you the same point of view on the news? You're not alone. The Campaign for Democratic Media is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group fighting to ensure that our public airwaves represent more than just one voice. Canadians deserve diverse, accountable, and quality Canadian media. Visit democraticmedia.ca to learn how you can stand up for media issues.
Standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would